You're listening to the Full and Thriving Podcast, a place where courageous women come to break free from food obsession, heal their relationship with their body, and strive to live a life that's present, lighthearted, and meaningful. If you're listening, my wish is that this podcast serves as a catalyst that inspires you to nourish your body, nurture your mind, and energize your spirit. I'm your host, Meg McCabe, a certified life coach and eating disorder recovery coach with a PhD in having a good time. Just kidding about that last part. Anyway, thank you so much for listening and enjoy the show. Do you ever wonder how factors such as race, religion, and culture impact the development of eating disorders? Or perhaps how these things impacted the development of your eating disorder? Would you like to better understand the challenges that the BIPOC community face when it comes to eating disorder recovery? Do you ever feel frustrated by the lack of diversity in the eating disorder recovery field? In this week's episode, I chat with Brianna Theus from the Celestial Life RD. Brianna is a Haitian dietitian who helps BIPOC individuals learn to eat without guilt and embrace their culture in recovery. This is a really helpful and eye-opening episode, so be sure to listen until the very end. I hope you enjoy this week's episode of Full and Thriving. Hey, Brianna, how are you today?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing so well. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's so nice to finally have a fellow Connecticut human chatting to me on this podcast. I speak to people from all over the world, all over the United States. Whenever I come across a fellow New Englander, I get very excited. So it makes me happy that you're only a stone's throw away from me on the map.
Right here, everyone is usually like, what is Connecticut? I've never heard of it. So it's nice to talk to you too.
Did you get your dietitian training in Connecticut too? Like, did you go to UConn or?
Yeah, I went to University of St. Joseph in West Hartford, actually, Connecticut.
That's right down the road from me. How exciting. I love that. That's a beautiful area too.
It is.
Okay, amazing. Well, I love that you're basically my neighbor. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I would love to just open with, how did you become a dietitian who specializes in eating disorders? And also, was this something you ever struggled with yourself? Because usually the story is combined.
When I was in school, eating disorders was not really on my mind all of that much. I actually didn't even want to be a dietitian either. I wanted to be a chef or a pastry chef. And my parents were like, no, you're not going to do that. So I was like, food, nutrition, I was like, they kind of go hand in hand. So this was my second option. And caveat, so glad that I took this option. But eating disorders, it ended up coming about because I knew I really liked counseling. We have a dietetic internship that we dietitians have to do after we graduate, and we do a bunch of different rotations in different fields. And I was doing diabetes counseling and heart health counseling, and I was like, oh, this is interesting. I like counseling, but I don't like this counseling that I'm doing right now. So it took me a little bit of time to do my own research. I started listening to some eating disorder podcasts and following some different dietitians on social media. And I was like, this is actually more in line with what I like, what my philosophies are about nutrition. So that is how I got into it. Personally, I didn't have an eating disorder, but I did struggle with disordered eating. Definitely had that traditional nutrition education of this is healthy, this is quote unquote healthy, this is not healthy, you need to counsel your clients in this way, weight loss, like all the things I learned. And I was like, okay, another aspect of this is that my family is Haitian and we will eat traditional Haitian food sometimes, which usually are made with white rice. So I told my parents they have to not eat white rice. They need to eat brown rice because it's quote unquote healthier. they need to cook with coconut oil because that was all of the craze back then. So definitely in that disordered eating mindset, and brown rice with Haitian food is not the way to go.
I feel like I'm so over brown rice in general. In food, it just doesn't fit.
No, does not fit at all. But I was like, yeah, this is great. But it was not good. So I used some of those experiences to help me further myself in my career to become an eating disorder dietitian.
Yeah, I think your story is so relatable. I remember going through my eating disorder as well. And I feel like it just infiltrated the family. Like suddenly I'm policing everyone's food in the house. And if you look back at photos of the family, everyone's just like lost weight during that era of time because we were dieting so much and it was not fun. I relate to that story, and it's unfortunate so many of us try to take it home and make it part of other people's lifestyles. So interesting story there. So you didn't struggle with an eating disorder. You had disordered eating. You also mentioned that you are Haitian. And so as a Haitian dietitian, I'm curious how that identity has impacted your work.
I grew up in a very white suburban town. So I never had a lot of people who looked like me in my day-to-day life. So being in this field of being a dietitian, even in the eating disorder field, it is mostly a majority white people. I think for dietitians specifically, I believe it's like 2.7% of dietitians are Black. So I was used to it. Like, I didn't think anything of it because it was just normal for me. But until I started working with, I was working in an eating disorder treatment facility, and I started working with a Black therapist who was more vocal about these things and more vocal about needing to have more BIPOC people on staff or needing to have more conversations about topics that relate to BIPOC folks. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. I never thought that that would be necessary, but she really opened my eyes to why it is important and why how I grew up isn't okay. It's important to have people who look like you on your side. So it really wasn't until maybe 3.5 years ago where I started to do the work myself to be able to have more conversations about race, have more conversations about the intersections of eating disorders with other people in the field and with my patients and clients as well.
It's so fascinating how you as a woman of color is navigating in a mostly white field and grew up in a white world. And then you're exposed to a Black therapist who explains all of this importance to you. What did she say to you that made you start getting your wheels to turn a little bit? Can you add some detail to that?
Trying to think back, one thing that she did was create a BIPOC group for the patients in that facility. And in her doing that, she had to advocate a lot for why the group was important, why it was necessary. And I think in that, it made me realize that these are conversations that we aren't having. Nothing has come up from the things that she is mentioning from the point of view. And I think also within that year and a half was when George Floyd was murdered as well. So that obviously brought up a lot of stuff as well. So it was really her actions and her conversations with a lot of people. And even if we would do group supervisions and somebody would talk about one of their clients and they were a client of color, and she would be like, well, have you talked about race with that client? And everyone would be like, no, of course not. And she would be like, well, I think you need to, because it's having an impact on the eating disorder. It's having an impact on just day-to-day life. So really, it was a bunch of things that she did, a bunch of things that she said that really made me realize that this is something that I need to be focusing on as well.
I think that's really important. And I think that's important for all practitioners in this field to hear, is it's probably more important to talk about how someone's race impacts their recovery journey and maybe has contributed to their eating disorder than just pretending it's not part of the equation at all.
100%.
So kind of on that note, I'm really curious about the factors specific to BIPOC individuals that have increased risk of maybe getting disordered eating or an eating disorder. Because I know that there are some points that I've heard of in conversation that I think your average white person might not be thinking about. So I'd love for you to touch on some of those points.
Yeah, there are so many points I think that add to the likelihood of developing an eating disorder. One of those is intergenerational trauma. So for example, if we're speaking about somebody who has grandparents who were enslaved, they are holding on to that trauma. It is getting passed down from generation to generation. And it can also be trauma from other things as well. But in thinking about race and thinking about religion, or even somebody who has gone through the Holocaust, right? Passing down that trauma from generation to generation and kind of holding on to that stress. And that is going to have a higher risk of developing an eating disorder by using food to cope for whatever reason, or not having those skills because your family didn't have those skills for themselves. They didn't have access to those things. They were always in that fight mode. They were always heightened because they had to be, right? They were going through these experiences. So that gets passed down generation to generation as well. And another aspect is the economic factors. So food apartheids are very present in the United States. And an example of that is if there are two towns or two cities, one is on one side of a train track, one is on the other side of a train track, they can have completely different circumstances. They can have completely different like outlines of what is available to them and what is accessible to them in their own respective towns. So one of them might have three Trader Joe's and they have a Whole Foods and they have a grocery store at least like 5 minutes from everyone. Whereas on the other side of the train tracks, they only have corner stores or bodegas. They don't have a full grocery store where they have access to different types of foods or fresh fruits and vegetables. Or even it is also shown that corner stores or bodegas are also more expensive than what a regular grocery store might be as well. And for those people who are on, let's say, the right side of the train track who don't have access to the grocery stores. Well, first of all, it's a mostly BIPOC community. Secondly, they may not also have access to different types of jobs, right? They might not have access to different types of education just because they are BIPOC and that wasn't prevalent for them. It still isn't always going to be prevalent for them as well. So maybe they don't have a car. They have no way of getting to the grocery store. And they have to go cross the train tracks to be able to get there. So what happens is they are working all day because they need to be providing for their families. They take the smallest amount of time that they have left in their day to either have to walk to the grocery store, to catch a ride to the grocery store with somebody. They have to travel all the way across, get what they need to get, and then get back home and cook and prepare and do all the things they need to do and then get ready for the next thing and do it all over again. Whereas somebody on the left side is like, okay, I'm going to go to the grocery store. I'm going to grab my stuff. I'm going to make a meal and it's going to be all good. I don't have to think about it, right? Where this other person has to plan their whole day around grocery shopping. So then what might happen is that like the access to food is lower. So maybe they're not eating for a couple of days, right? Maybe they don't have the ability to go to the grocery store. So they're trying to make their food stretch longer. And sometimes what will happen is the parents or the caregivers will allow the children to eat. Maybe they're not eating because they don't have enough food for everybody. Or in the more extreme circumstances, nobody is able to eat enough for that day. And then if they are able to then go to the grocery store, they have access to food from a food pantry or a church or wherever they're getting food from. Sometimes what will happen is that since food has been scarce, then a binge might occur because they haven't had access to food for so long and their brain and their body is like, oh my God, there's food available for me. I am going to eat as much of it as I can before it goes away before I don't have access to it anymore. So that binge restrict cycle will start in that sense. And even though it's not something that is intentional, I guess, I don't think it's always intentional, but even if it's not intentional, it's still developing into an eating disorder.
Wow, that is so eye-opening and sounds really even exhausting thinking about having to plan your whole day around going to the grocery store.
Yeah.
And I could see how if you're not prioritizing food, like maybe you have the predisposition for an eating disorder in the first place, and you're not prioritizing food at all, it's probably 10 times more difficult to get yourself to the store when you have to be there if you're already having some sort of disordered mentality about food.
Yeah, yeah. And on top of that, too, if there is no access to somebody's cultural foods, right, foods that they would typically eat. Like I mentioned, my family is Haitian, so I eat a lot of Haitian food. And I've even had a few clients who, actually, I had one in particular who came here from Africa, from a country in Africa, and she wasn't eating because she didn't have access to her African foods here in Connecticut. She was like, I can't find them anywhere. So what am I supposed to be eating? I don't want to have a sandwich. Like, that's not normal for me to be eating. I don't want to be eating these typical foods. So I just haven't been really eating anything. So if somebody's needing to go across the train tracks to the Whole Foods, to the Trader Joe's, they're not going to have the foods that they are used to eating, that they want to be eating, and that they have a right to be eating as well. So it adds that extra layer on top too.
Wow. Yeah, that's really interesting too. It's like, I can't see this from that perspective until you share that story, right? But I feel like it's almost like going to a store where you have a really strong allergy. I think at the end of the day, that sounds very limiting for that individual and extremely difficult. And so I'm really curious about this component because I hear many Instagram content creators talking about colonialism in food and whitewashing food. And I'd love for you to explain what that means and how that's showing up, if possible. I'm guessing going to Whole Foods instead of having your African cultural foods is a good example, but I'd love for you to expand on it.
I think there are a couple of aspects to this. And I think I'll start with one thing is that if we are thinking about, we'll take Mexican food, for example. Mexican food for a lot of people is something that they eat on their quote unquote cheat days. It is something that they label as unhealthy. It is something that they say, oh, I'm going to go to Taco Bell and eat Mexican food, or I'm going to go to Chipotle and eat Mexican food, when that's not Mexican food, right? That is Americanized Mexican food, if we can even call it that. Then adds the layer of somebody who is Mexican wants to be eating their cultural foods, but then those feelings of guilt, those feelings of shame arise because they're like, well, I'm not supposed to be eating those foods because they're not good for me. They're not healthy for me. People only eat them on the weekends or when they're okay with, I don't know, not being good, quote unquote, by eating the foods that they want to be eating. So I need to be assimilating, right? I need to be eating the foods that are not my cultural foods. I call this the California diet. I need to be eating the avocados. And even though avocados are part of a lot of cultural foods, but they have also been taken over in a way and made it a lot more expensive. Though I need to be eating avocados and eating the kale and eating the quinoa and all of these things, even though I don't like it, but I'm going to be eating it because that is what I'm supposed to be doing. And then the other factor is that that also may help them feel like they are going to be able to fit in with other people as well.
I think that's so multifaceted because there's the layer of assimilation, like I want to fit in and this is what I can do to maybe not draw so much attention to myself. And then we're all assigning like moral judgment to cultural foods through diet culture. So there's this internalized labeling of this food is bad, right? When really it's probably a bunch of people in California labeled it as bad. I can see how those two layers come into play to make it a really complex situation for a BIPOC person.
Yeah, I hear a lot of stories about people who grew up, they were in school, they're bringing food for school lunch, and they were eating the foods that their parents or their grandparents or their aunts or uncles were making them. And they would stop bringing them to school because they would get bullied because of their foods, or their people would comment and be like, oh my gosh, like that food smells so bad. Or they would have all of these things to say about their traditional cultural foods that they wanted to be eating. So they obviously didn't want to have those interactions. They didn't want to have those experiences, especially as a young kid, to have to deal with that. So then they would ask their parents to give them sandwiches or ask to have pizza or anything like that for their lunches instead. That way they didn't have to deal with any of those interactions, and they could just be normal, right? Quote unquote normal, and feel like they fit in with everybody else.
Mm-hmm. I could just imagine when I was a kid, I did not want to be standing out in any way. I did not want to be made fun of. So if I was in that situation, I'd be running home asking to have the food that everyone else was eating. My heart goes out to little kids who have to deal with that complicated situation. And I'm sure the parents at home might not necessarily understand even what's happening there.
Yeah, because then it's like, why don't you want to eat our food? Like, you love these foods. And then especially in a lot of different cultures, it can feel or it can be seen as negative to their caregivers, negative to the elders, to ask them to change something, to tell them you don't want what they're providing for you. So sometimes the kids have to take it. They bring it to school, they go through those experiences. And then when they're older, then they stop eating their cultural foods. When they have more of an opportunity, then they stop doing that. It can happen in various different ways as well, various different times in their childhood, in their adulthood, to where it might feel like those things I can't have as part of my life, I can't have as part of my diet.
Mm-hmm. That makes me so sad. It's like as an adult, it's so much easier to embrace cultural diversity in food. That's what makes food so exciting. But I think as a kid, it's hard to understand. And with your Haitian background, was that something you went through as a kid in Connecticut? I mean, I grew up here too, so I'm wondering, probably went to a similar type of school that you went to. What was it like for you?
Yeah, I was bringing a lot of homemade food to school. And my mom is also a single mom. So it was like anything quick that she could give me. So there were a couple times that I came home and I was like, hey, I need something different. I don't want this anymore. I didn't tell her why. She was just like, why are you being difficult? But it was because there were comments on what I was bringing. And I was like, can I just buy lunch at school? Why can't I just do this? And she was like, no, I made this food. You have to eat it. So I remember, I can't even remember how old I was, but there is one specific time that is like ingrained in my memory when I was in school and I refused to eat the food that my mom gave me. And whoever was like the lunch person at that time made me sit at the table for like an hour after lunch was over so I could eat my food, and I still wouldn't eat the food. And I was there by myself. It was just me and this lunch person, which was also like traumatic in and of itself. But
that's interesting. I wonder where that was coming from. She just didn't want you to not eat.
Yeah, she didn't want me to not eat, which fair. But I was like, I can't eat this food. I asked for something different because of what would happen if I even just like take the food out of my lunch bag and people see it and they see that it is different from what they would be eating. Like, I just want to have a sandwich and I'll be fine with that.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So how does this conversation about cultural assimilation and like cultural foods, how does that impact people as adults who are developing eating disorders? Like, does this manifest into an eating disorder down the road?
I think it could manifest in a couple of different ways. And I'm thinking specifically of the binge eating that we were talking about before. Because they are not eating this food, their cultural foods, it can become like a scarcity, right? The scarcity mindset that food is not accessible, it's not available. So maybe the next time they have it, maybe they go over to a family member's house for a holiday or whatever, and that food is available to them. And then they end up binging on that food because they haven't had it for so long, especially if it's food that they really enjoy and they want to be eating. It can then develop into that aspect. But then they go home and they're like, I still can't have that food. So the cycle, the restrict, the binge cycle starts over again as well. And then the other example I'm thinking of is, I guess also specifically to the example with the client I was mentioning before, where she didn't have access to her cultural foods. So that ended up restricting because she didn't want to eat anything else. It wasn't pleasing. It wasn't appealing to her. So she wasn't eating. And then again, like being predisposed already added on top of that. And it developed into an eating disorder.
That's all really interesting and thought-provoking to think about how an individual's eating disorder is rooted in something so complex. Like everyone's eating disorder has different roots. And these are examples that, you know, as a white individual, we don't necessarily think about because we have the privilege of our own cultural foods accessible mostly everywhere. One thing I'm thinking about, which probably you can tell me otherwise, but I'm guessing there's a lot of secrecy and shame associated with eating too, if there's shame around your cultural foods. And we all know shame perpetuates disordered behaviors and secret eating from the get-go.
Yeah, there is a lot of secrecy and shame. And I'm also thinking about it in maybe the opposite way of the secrecy, if especially if somebody is living with their family, the secrecy of eating these like European American type foods, not wanting their family to know that they are eating these foods. And especially I'm thinking about people who have immigrated here, and this is coming from someone I have spoken to before. Their grandparents, their parents immigrated here. And they are like, I have sacrificed all this for you to be able to be here, for you to have a good life, et cetera, et cetera. And you are eating these foods that are not from our culture. Like, why are you doing that? Food in a lot of different cultures is so, so important. And to not eat the food from your culture, it, like, again, can be a sign of rebelling, a sign of just like being rude to the elders and not doing the things that they want you to be doing. So the secrecy, the shame can also just be coming from, I'm eating these foods. And maybe also this person wants to be eating the American type foods, and which is also fine. They want to be eating those foods, but they don't want their family to know that they're eating those foods as well.
Oh my gosh, so complicated. So much to feel as a little kid or someone who's immigrated into America. That's really a lot. And I could see food is complicated already, but adding that cultural layer could just maximize how complicated it can get. It's complicated to people with eating disorders. It's not always complicated to everybody, but I mean, I can see how that would get difficult. Any other factors? I'm thinking like, as far as specific to BIPOC individuals, I know you speak a lot about religion and eating disorders. And could you touch on that as well?
Yes. Religion and eating disorders. And I guess this can pertain to anybody, but religion and eating disorders, there is a big intersection. And religion can be both a protective factor for an eating disorder or a risk factor. So a protective factor, meaning that it is something that is going to help not develop an eating disorder or help protect you in any way, help keep you safe. And not even just talking about eating disorders, but in general, it's just something that is beneficial for you. Whereas a risk factor is going to be something that will potentially lead to developing an eating disorder or developing anything else, really. So religion as a protective factor, it can have the aspect of community, right? Something that colonialism has taken away from us, I think we see this in society in the United States, is this focus on individualism. We are so focused on, you have to get yourself to the top. You have to do all of this yourself. Whereas in a lot of different cultures, and a lot of different religions, the focus is on collectivism, which is working together with a bunch of people, having community to have support, to be able to talk to about things. So the community aspect of religion can be a big protective factor, having people to either like catch things for you, being like, what is happening? Let's talk about this. Or having people to just talk to, having people to be surrounded by, and people who look like you, people who believe in the same things as you, that can be a protective factor. Also, having something to believe in can be important as well, giving somebody a higher sense of self, like something else that they're living for as well can really be beneficial, someone to pray to, depending on the religion as well. But then the risk factors can be potentially growing up in a religious household and religion being forced upon you. Right, not wanting to necessarily be a part of this religion, but you're going through the motions, you're going to the services. Maybe I'm specifically thinking about Christianity in this, going to youth groups, doing the things because that's something that you have to do, because that's what your family tells you you have to do, but not something that you want to be doing for yourself. So sometimes it can occur where somebody is fasting, because that's something that they have to be doing, or somebody is participating in any of the events because they feel like they have to be doing that. And then they get praise, right? You fasted for however long. I can't believe you were able to do that. That's so amazing. And that could make somebody feel good, right? They're getting praised for doing something that they didn't even want to be doing, but they're getting praised for it. So they're, oh, I got the praise for that. I enjoy getting the praise. I enjoy having people see me for the things that I'm doing. So I'm going to try doing it again. Right. And specifically with the fasting, then it leads to I'm seeking the results of what happens from doing this one thing. So I'm going to keep doing it. And then again, developing into the disordered eating disorder by continuing to fast, which is restricting a lot of the time. That's definitely one way. Or something I have seen as well with religion is if a family member gets sick, for example, somebody in your life gets sick and feeling like the religion has failed you, right? I wasn't good enough in my religion. I wasn't good enough at praying. I wasn't good enough at fasting. I wasn't good enough at doing any of these things. And because I wasn't good enough, this is what happened to this person who is really close to me. So I don't deserve whatever, right? I don't deserve food. I don't deserve this. I don't deserve to be part of this religion anymore because I didn't do it right. And then with that, that person also loses their community. Right? They lose their sense of self. They lose something that they want to believe in. So they have lost all of these aspects that were so protective for them because this happened. And now they don't have much, right? Especially if religion is something that was a strong part of their life.
Man, first of all, so hard to hear that religion can have that impact, almost predispose someone to getting an eating disorder without realizing it through the fasting. And then the lack of community, if you feel like you weren't, quote, good enough when something bad happens to you. I've seen that before in my practice as well. So it's unfortunate, but I do appreciate how you share that religion can be a protector too in both areas. So thank you for sharing all of that. I actually think about Lent. I grew up Catholic. And I've gotten people in my DMs asking about Lent, being like, oh, should I just give up food? And that's where I feel like there's such a diet-centric approach to that period of time in the Christian religion or Catholic religion is like, someone might be like, I'm going to give up dessert. And then they see all these, like maybe they lose weight because they don't have dessert for 40 days. And then it turns into an eating disorder. So it's interesting how these religious practices can have a shadow side that we don't think of the impact necessarily.
Yeah, definitely. And that made me think of pastors. I grew up non-denominational Christian. So I've been to all the church services, I've listened to like to Christian radio and all of these things. I always hear, you know, like weight loss is so great, dieting, like always talking about food, always talking about diets. I know, especially in some churches or even some religions in general, talking about gluttony as being a sin, right? Talking about food as being a sin. And then again, making somebody feel really bad for whatever is going on in their lives, pushing them away versus pulling them in and helping them and supporting them in the way that they need. But I have, with Lent, I definitely have that a lot in my practice too. Like, I struggle with going out to eat. I'm going to give up going out to eat for Lent. And then that brings up a whole conversation of like, is that going to be beneficial for you in the long run? And let's talk about this a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Like, what is the intention here? Is it to lose weight or is it to connect to your religion more deeply?
Right.
Ask yourself, and I hope you can answer that honestly, because I think a lot of people are not going to be true about the intentions. But anyway, religion is such an important piece of the puzzle as well. And, you know, going back to the conversation, and I know what religion can include white and non-white individuals in the discussion, but, you know, one thing we touched on in the beginning of this conversation is the lack of diversity in the eating disorder field. And how does that impact BIPOC folks with eating disorders? Like, how does that impact their recovery journey?
Yeah, a lot of people, not everyone, a lot of people want to work with people who look like them. They want to have their dietitian, their therapist, their, like, everybody on their team. They want to have even at least one person who looks like them. And because the field is one, majority white, two, majority female, also a lot of people may be thin. There was one other thing that I was going to say, but now I can't remember.
Like cisgendered or heterosexual?
Maybe. Okay. Majority cisgender. They aren't able to get access to the care that they want, right? They want somebody who is going to be able to understand where they're coming from without them having to educate that person where they are coming from, right? Or maybe be able to understand their family life, understand how they grew up without having to explain the whole process, especially if they have multiple people on their team, they're going to have to explain it multiple times. It can be frustrating. It can be time consuming. And they're like, I just want to get my care. I don't want to have to educate you during my session that I'm paying you for. Oh, the other thing I was going to say was not a lot of, specifically for dietitians, not a lot of insurance-based dietitians as well. Right. So also the access kind of dwindles down. Right. So you're not getting somebody who looks like you. You're not getting somebody who looks like you in multiple ways. Right. You're not getting somebody who you can use your insurance for. Who am I going to go to? What do I do in that circumstance? So then they end up again, like seeing somebody who may not fully understand and having to do some education for that person or having to. Even microaggressions might occur, right? They might experience further trauma from their care because the provider isn't educated or well-informed or hasn't done their own work in order to be able to have these conversations, bring these things into sessions with all of their clients.
That is an unfortunate situation, and also something that I could see being so important and also a barrier, like having to explain your situation to someone over and over and over again in a session that you are paying for. Like, sounds like not an effective use of time for an expensive session. But unfortunately, that background information is probably important to be said. And so I could see how someone needs someone who looks like them so that doesn't have to come into play and take up time. As far as diversity in the space goes, what do you think needs to change so that there are more BIPOC providers out there? Like, how do we increase those numbers? I know you said it was 2.7% of dietitians are Black. That is such a small percentage. How do we increase that? What needs to change? I know there are probably so many systemic pieces coming into play here, but what are your thoughts?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. All of these systemic issues, making therapy programs, making nutrition programs, making all the programs more accessible for all people, but also having the representation. So maybe it's like people like me being on podcasts, giving talks to high school students or college students and having them see that there are other people who look like them in the field. So that puts a little bit more on BIPOC providers, and eventually it will help in terms of just like having more diversity in the field. And even if it's people on social media, I know there are plenty of BIPOC dietitians on social media in the eating disorder space who are talking about these things, who are very active, and that will open up some minds for people who maybe are thinking about being a dietitian, who can then see these people doing the thing that they want to be doing and enjoying the field that they want to be doing as well. Besides the whole systemic issues of needing to just like take it down to the root, having the exposure. Thank you.
Yeah. And I think that exposure will also help individuals struggling with eating disorders who don't see people like them in the media struggling with eating disorders, right? I think that's why the diagnosis rates are lower, right? Because it's harder to see yourself or accept that diagnosis that doesn't feel like it applies to you, if that makes sense. I don't know if I'm phrasing it the best, but that's what I've heard. And that also feels like a barrier to treatment, and also a barrier to maybe someone becoming a dietitian in this space, because they don't see many examples of Black dietitians out there or Black therapists out there. So it's all about setting the example, I guess, and seeking that exposure so other people can see what's possible for them.
Definitely. Yeah. And I also think that if there are any professors in schools who can have these conversations, right? Even if they are not BIPOC, they are able to bring in conversations about cultural foods, bring in conversations about weight stigma and eating disorders. I didn't have any eating disorder education in school, right? Having these conversations to be able to show people that it is okay for them to want to pursue this, okay for them to want to have conversations and talk about this as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much, Brianna, for sharing all of your wisdom with us today and all the lovely information. I really appreciate it. And before I let you go, I'm just curious if you could please share where they can find you, how they can work with you, and if you have anything coming up that you'd like to promote, please take this time to share with everyone.
Of course. My Instagram is TheCelestialLifeRD. My website is TheCelestialLife.com. So everything is The Celestial Life. You can find me there, or you can just Google my name and everything will pop up as well. I have a couple of things coming up. I have a BIPOC nutrition support group that is once a month currently. Pay what you can, even if it's $0, totally fine. It's called the community. So just to increase community, have more support, have that collectivistic energy going on in eating disorder care. I also will have, hopefully next year, if I get my act together, I will have a course for cooking. If cooking is something that is really difficult for you and you want to learn how to cook, you want to learn more about food, even just get the basics of cooking, I will have something for that in the next year.
I love that. I don't hear too many people offering cooking classes in the dietitian space of eating disorders, but it's so necessary. So I'm excited to hear more about that. And thank you so much for sharing all of those resources for listeners. And again, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome.
All right, that concludes this week's episode of the Full and Thriving Podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to this episode of the show. When you have a moment, please head on over to Instagram and follow my recovery coaching account at Meg_McCabe to stay up to date on everything I'm doing in recovery land. And if you're feeling extra inspired, please send me a direct message to let me know how this podcast has impacted your life. I'd love to hear your feedback. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you next week.